It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our Hidden Wisconsin series and talk to the designer of a corn maze.
First, though, the Wausau School Board is holding a special meeting this evening to talk about what has become a controversy over how much religious music the high school's choir can perform at its holiday concert.
The school's choir group, Master Singers, was disbanded last week after the choral director was asked to include fewer religious songs or postpone the holiday concert.
Tonight is the first time the school board will address that issue directly.
We have Keith Ulig with us to tell us what's going on. He's the education reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So a lot of people around the state may not be up on this story. What did we learn last Friday? What broke then?
What broke then was a teacher, a popular choir teacher, choir director at Wausau West High School, disbanded the Master Singers group, and that's sort of an elite, high-level singing group that traditionally during the holiday season has gone to like service clubs, businesses, etc., to perform a winter concert.
And then this is after the school board requested what exactly?
The school board has not requested anything. This was after a review of music teachers' song list for performances done by an administrative committee. This is sort of at an administrative level. And what this committee, we're getting conflicting reports on what this committee told Phil. Phil Book believes that he was told you either have to have a 1-to-5 ratio of 5 secular songs for every religious song that you perform at these concerts, and he felt, or not have any religious songs at all, or delay these performances. And he said, he told us at the time that the whole purpose for these performances is to celebrate the holiday season, and he disbanded the group.
And is the music we're talking about that people are concerned about, this administrative committee was concerned about, modern, contemporary religious music or stuff from the classical canon, a lot of which was religious to begin with?
That's a good question. I've asked it. We don't know specifically what was on that song list. What we do know is that an attorney who was also part of this review process determined that what the Master Singers were doing, in effect, was Christmas caroling, and that runs counter to what a public school should be doing.
Now, the reaction in the community, I'm guessing as the education reporter for the Wausau paper there, this is probably one of the hotter reactions you've gotten to a story in a while.
Yeah, I think, I think the temperature, it actually affected the temperature here. It's just been great lately.
warm things up, huh?
Unseasonably warm, yes. I think I had 10 phone calls on this today. That's a lot for me. A lot of story response, a lot of chatter on online, like Facebook, Twitter, that sort of thing. And I think this is an issue that has sort of galvanized people here in Wausau and well beyond Wausau.
I know we haven't done a survey or anything, but what's the general sentiment? Are people mad about the request to change the music, or is it kind of mixed? Some people agree, some people don't.
I would say it's fair to say that most people do not agree with this decision to limit. Well, it's more than fair. I haven't heard anybody come out in full support of the district in the way that it has handled the situation. I think one of the big things was this 4-to-1 or 5-to-1. I'm still unclear about, this, but the sort of arbitrary number assigned to it. And in the course of my reporting, I spoke with Charles Haynes from the First Amendment Center, who is a national expert on, public education and the role of religion and how it can be taught. And he said that he could not find a reason for that. Now, Phil Book said that was like what he was told, you have to do this, and that this would be sort of the, like a hard and fast rule. The district said that was never the intent, that it was merely a suggestion, an example, to show how a musical performance cannot be a predominantly religious.
So now the school board is caught up in the story. Have they been speaking publicly about this leading up to tonight's meeting?
Not much. I spoke on Tuesday to the school board president, and she did not want to speak specifically to the issue. She said she wanted to hear what people had to say and address it at the meeting tonight. Another school board member today just basically wants the district to counteract, is what he told my colleague yesterday.
And
counteract,
yet,
the ruling.
And that's part of the issue here, is the kind of muddled and a little bit of he said, she said issue, right? So
that's,
we're hearing
exactly
from the
it.
Choir director, this is what I was directed to do. The schools are saying, no, we didn't say that exactly. And it sounds like it's been hard to untangle exactly what was communicated there.
That's exactly it. And it's been difficult to get people to speak on the record. It's been difficult to, contact people. They've been in meetings. I believe, at the administrative level, the school district has been inundated.
So at tonight's meeting, what is this? What's the setup for? Just a public hearing for people to vent, or is there a pretty specific agenda here on this?
The school board will meet in closed session prior to the public meeting, so that'll be held at 5:30, and that's to discuss strategies under lawsuit threats. So they've been threatened with lawsuits from this issue, not prior to the issue, not prior to the controversy, but since then. And then at 6:30, they will be holding this meeting in the auditorium of Wausau East High School. I'm not sure how many people that holds, but it's big. And they will, the district plans to sort of lay out its story, I guess, maybe clarify things, and then give people a chance to speak, and then there is a possibility the school board could make a decision. There's also a school board meeting on Monday night.
Underlying all this, it's kind of like this high voltage wire. Anytime you talk about religious issues in the public sphere, especially public schools, do you think this is just tapping into this sort of thing that flares up over prayer at graduations or anything like that?
I think there might have been a perfect storm of a public relations nightmare with this particular issue, in the fact that it wasn't clarified first. People have taken the there's a Facebook, Wausau School District cancels Christmas. And, I think, yes, that touches that third rail. Mm-hmm. And it really gets people heated up. Charles Haynes said, this, for many people, it is, sort of the last... in essence, they see this as being their faith being taken away from them, their schools being taken away from them.
And the impression I get hearing from our WPR staff in that area, the Master Singers are a pretty big deal in the community.
Yeah, and Phil Book is a very popular teacher, and he has built a program. I think he's a 37-year teacher. He has built a singing program, a choir program that is just terrific. They have performed, and I don't think this is just the Master Singers, but the larger choir has performed internationally. They have done CDs, so it is a big deal, and it is, I think, a big part of the culture here.
All right, so I know we can't predict the future. Do you think we're going to end up with a choir season this year when all is said and done?
This is my personal opinion. I think this will be worked out tonight, but you never know. I've covered a lot of these sorts of issues, and I'm often blindsided.
All right. Well, first the government shutdown and now this.
Yes.
Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Keith Ulig. He's education reporter at the Wausau Daily Herald. By the way, that Wausau School Board meeting is this evening at 6:30. It's at the auditorium of the Wausau East High School.
Now we'll check the headlines and get lost in a corn maze in this week's Hidden Wisconsin segment. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Well, autumn is in full swing, and a lot of us are making our way through corn mazes on the weekends. I just did, actually, last weekend.
But have you ever wondered how they actually make those mazes? In today's Hidden Wisconsin segment, we're about to find out.
Angie Trinan's with us. She's the owner of Trinan Farm with her husband, Alan. She designs the corn mazes and is in charge of orchestrating their October attractions there. Angie, welcome to Central Time.
I'm really excited to be here, or virtually here.
Yep, thanks. Yeah, by phone. How long have you had that corn maze at Trinan Farm?
Well, we put our first corn maze in 2001, but we've had a fall business for almost 25 years, or at least my husband has. About 24 years ago, he bought a team of draft horses. He just likes horses, and planted some pumpkins. And so that aspect of our business, the pumpkin patch, has been going on for a lot longer. But the corn maze started in 2001, and that's when we really started having a fall business that was pretty large scale, much larger scale.
What made you think you wanted to have a corn maze? How did you get the idea?
Well, we were having people come out to do our pumpkin patch, and they'd have a good time and just enjoy being on the farm, and we had some activities for the kids, play areas, that kind of thing. But we'd heard of people doing corn mazes, and we didn't really know what that was. I mean, so we went and visited a corn maze that was in Wisconsin, and we went in August, and it was so hot, incredibly hot. And, we live on a farm, so it's not really a thrill to be, like, in the corn maze. I mean, it wasn't that exciting. And I'm like, why would anybody do this, it's like 95 degrees. But we could see the potential for it. So then the next year we put in a corn maze, and we initially thought that the people who came out to do the pumpkin patch would then have the option to do the corn maze, and they do. But we found we really have two populations of visitors to the farm. We have horse-drawn wagon rides out to the pumpkin patch, and that tends to be predominantly families with younger children. Of course, grandmas and grandpas and anybody can do it. But we were finding that visitors would stop coming after their kids got a little bit older, and I'd see them around town, and they'd be like, oh, we used to come and have such a great time, and now we can't come anymore. I'd say, well, we do allow people to come even if they don't have young children. But the corn maze is more of an older children and adult kind of activity, because it's more challenging. And so that brought people back. So the people who had started off with their little kids getting those fall pictures with the horses and the pumpkin patch were now coming back as, older kids and teenagers and families, and a lot of adults coming out, with an adult group to do the maze, which takes 45 minutes to an hour to navigate through, and a lot of people will come and do it in the dark, too, which is even more challenging.
Well, so, Angie, you're the creative director there. How do you come up with a design for the corn maze?
Well, I get asked the question all year round, what's next year's corn maze going to be? Because we obviously grow new corn every year, which that's a question we sometimes get. Do we grow a new maze every year? Does the corn just stay? Which, if you didn't know how corn grew, I suppose that would be a reasonable question. But I just gather ideas throughout the year. So I'll see something that looks interesting, and I'll put it in my idea file, or I'll see something on the internet, or I start a Pinterest board on things that might make a cool maze. But I don't actually figure out what it's going to be until I start the maze design process, and I don't start the maze design process until I have a pretty firm deadline from my husband, who has basically planted the corn and will need the design within 2 weeks. So then I just go through my idea file and start to play with images. And it's one of the most fun parts of the whole operation is to take that time to be creative and be kind of a I consider myself an artist who only works in the medium of corn.
That's convenient here in Wisconsin. Well, I'm curious about how you actually get the corn to grow in that shape. It seems complicated.
Well, it is until you realize a lot of people will come out and, like, right now the corn is about 10 feet tall. So you're walking around in there and it's like, how on earth would you cut this design into the field? But you got to imagine that the corn is just coming up, because that's when we do it. So I'll get the design all set on a graphic design program, and then I will print it out on a grid, basically. And then I hand that to my husband, who is the farmer, and I say, here, honey, here's your design. Cut it into the field. And he looks at me and says, are you kidding? This is like, this is so complicated. But when he plants the field, he plants it in a grid. So normal cornfields are just rows. He will plant this field two ways. So there is a grid growing in the field. And so basically by counting rows, and he'll put stakes and flags out to make it a little easier, he can figure out where he is in the field relative to the plan on the page at any given point. And then he and his crew will, so the corn's just coming up, you know, just a few inches tall, or less than a foot tall, basically, will go and mark where the trails are supposed to be, with a lot of precision. And then they'll till, eventually, once they're for sure everything's in the right spot, they'll till it out with a tiller, which will kill the corn in the trails. And then the pattern just grows up into the field.
See, I had pictured, or I wanted it to be, that you wandered through with a machete in late August when the corn was getting pretty high. I
mean,
but that's your way is easier, I think.
Yeah, well, if you do it with a GPS system, you can do it when the corn is relatively tall. But since we cut ours by hand, that's not really an option. Once you can't see where those rows are anymore, that's all over. So there's always a little deadline pressure with that, too, is getting that maze cut.
So once you've got it done, do you actually walk it yourself to make sure it's fun?
I go out and, I spend a little time in there. It's always fun because we make it complicated enough that it's fun. I personally don't spend a lot of time in it this time of year because I'm busy kind of managing employees and doing promotion and that kind of thing. But it is, I do enjoy being in there.
So you've got a Kraken this year, I think, right? How did you come up with that for this year's design?
Well, we don't do anything that's, copyrighted, or that we try to do more, not characters, that kind of thing. And I just started thinking about the things that I really like. This is kind of all about me when I'm in the design process. And I was thinking about doing an octopus, because I was thinking, oh, they're so beautiful and they're so interesting, and with all the tentacles and then the suckers, I'm like, this will be complicated. But then I was like, it's just not exciting enough. There's got to be an element of drama or danger, something. And then I'm like, well, okay, what if it was a kraken, a giant squid, and it was attacking a ship, and that was it. It was like perfect.
Well, do you still, eat the corn when the season's over and we're heading into winter? Does that corn get used?
Well, we do harvest the corn and we sell it. It's not sweet corn like where you would sell it, directly to people to eat. It's feed corn, basically sold on the corn market. And we do harvest it. I can't say it's the most efficient way to grow corn because it's designed to be a good maze, but corn does, the ears are harvested, and depending on the year, it can be good. So,
do you ever get overhead pictures either from a plane or maybe the corn silo, so you really see, because you can't see it when you're in it?
No, you can't see it when you're in it, and we always get we usually get two photos from the air. We'll get one photo from the air as soon as it's cut, so that we can correct the map or correct the field, depending on, if they forget to cut a trail or a trail doesn't turn out quite right. It has to be exactly accurate to the map, because our customers know that the maps are very accurate. And then later in this, like usually by August, my husband will go up again. We'll track down somebody local who has a small airplane, and he'll take photos. But this year it was kind of interesting. We had somebody come over who has a drone service, or is selling drones to especially crop scouting companies, And he brought his drone up, and we took our he took our preliminary photos with the drone, and it was really cool.
Wow.
It was really fun. but you have to be about at least 1,000 feet up to really see the full design. And we take a lot of care with our photo, because if you go on our website and take a look at the photo, it's a pretty dramatic photo, and it has very dark, a lot of shadows in it, basically, which really makes the photo look a lot better. And, you know, I think that's really key. I'm like, no, it has to be really close to sunset or really close to sunrise. And it just makes it a lot more visually appealing.
Do you ever have people who get lost in the maze? I feel like I've come pretty close before.
Yeah.
Where you're going to have to send out a search party.
Well, I will feel like I've failed if people don't actually get lost, you know, in the maze to a certain degree. I mean, I don't want people to be, you know, like so frustrated that they're gnawing off people's limbs or something. Yeah, it's designed to be tricky enough that even a good navigator may have a little, you know, moments of questioning here. People always find their way out. And a lot of times we have, you know, a lot of people in the maze and somebody can help you out. And we've never had anybody permanently lost in there. So.
Well, just in our last 30 seconds, any ideas what next year's maze might look like?
Well, I actually ask customers a lot, any ideas, and a lot of people will email me with great ideas, and I do use those a lot for my process. So that's the only thing I can say.
All right. It's a secret for now.
Yep.
Angie, thank you so much for joining us. A lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was Angie Trinan, owner of Trinan Farm with her husband, Alan. And she is, as we've heard, the designer of their annual corn maze.
And we have a link to the Trinan Farm website on our Facebook page. You can go and check out the Kraken Maze and post about maybe your favorite corn mazes here in Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll be talking fall baking with Ian Knauer.
And some say we're in a golden age of television. Well, our guest says we're also in a golden age of television theme songs.
Then, is ethical parenting possible in a world where parents often game the system to give their kids a leg up?
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about your favorite horror films with film critic Mike Mayo. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's the perfect time of year to stay in and watch a scary movie. The weather's chilly, and of course, Halloween is right around the corner.
But what scary movie should you watch? Lucky for you, we're talking to an expert on horror movies now.
And we want to know, in the meantime, what is your favorite scary movie? What horror movie would you recommend to scare the daylights out of someone? And do you have a favorite cheeseball horror movie? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'll start taking calls right away, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike Mayo joins us now. He's author of The Horror Show Guide, the ultimate fright fest of movies. He's a film critic who's contributed to The Washington Post and The Roanoke Times. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, think back. What is your first horror movie memory, and how did it affect you?
Oh, gosh. The very first one that I saw was a time that my parents let me stay up and watch a late show. And it was the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm.
And that movie scared me. And it's just a terrific movie still. And I think all of the remakes that they've done of it don't even come close to it, because that, to me, is just one of those near-perfect movies. It's really short, tells us really good story, limited special effects, great characters, one of the best.
I'm kind of laughing ruefully along with you, Mike, because my mom made a bad parenting call and took me to see that when I was, you know, maybe like 11 or 12, and it still has scarred me to this day.
Yep,
we had to leave in ignominy. So, yeah, that's one that sticks with you. I mean, since you were so scared, that was your first one. What made you a horror fan? What do you like about them?
Well, I just like the horror films kind of, you know, tickle that old reptile part of the brain, you know, fight or flight, in a way that other movies don't. And I think for a lot of kids, they are sort of an introduction into the world of adult movies. Clearly, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was not meant for young audiences, but I could see it, understand it, the idea of adults kind of going crazy and turning weird. I understood that immediately. And so I think that's it. That's what gets a lot of kids into it. And once you see the right movies at the right time, you're hooked for life.
For your book, you've got a pretty broad definition of horror. You include things like Alien, which some people might just call science fiction, Contagion, which is a disease thriller.
Yep.
Why did you broaden the definition past what we might think of as like a supernatural or serial killer horror?
It is so hard to make really strong, bright definitions between, like you say, horror and crime well, I guess all supernatural is pretty much horror. But I just decided any movie that sets out to scare you is a horror movie. And if it scares you really well, then it's a really good horror movie. And Alien is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Yes, technically it's science fiction, but that's got some of the scariest stuff I've ever seen on a movie screen.
Yeah, agreed. Let's go to our first caller. We've got Max on the line from Oshkosh. Hi, Max.
Well, hi. Happy Thursday, everybody.
You too.
Hey, I don't know if this fits exactly into the horror genre, but one of the scariest movies I ever saw, and I continue to watch it to this day, is Jaws. It was amazing to me because you didn't see the shark until about halfway through the movie. I mean, it was all suspense. It was crazy. And
yeah.
It was just it was terrifying when I was a kid, and I lost a lot of sleep over it. Going back to it.
Yep, I hear you there, Max.
I couldn't even go into the bathtub when I was a kid.
Yeah, what about Jaws, Mike?
I agree completely. And again, like we were saying, you know, it's hard to tell exactly where the lines are there. But look at Steven Spielberg. He has been making horror movies all through his career. One of his first big hits was a movie that he made for television called Duel, with Dennis Weaver, about a guy who gets involved with a crazed truck driver. And then we had Jaws, of course, and I think Jurassic Park is another excellent horror movie.
Well,
he goes for the big monsters, and he does them very well.
So you consider Jurassic Park a horror movie, too. That's one of those on-the-line ones, but I guess you're right. It is scary.
Yeah, and any movie with giant dinosaurs in it is kind of a horror movie.
Well, Max brought up a good point about Jaws, about not seeing the shark through so much of the movie, and the scary part is what you don't see. And I think of some of the better episodes in the Nightmare on Elm Street series, where it's the lurking shadow, not, you know, Freddy Krueger full on, you know, seeing his face, you know, right in front of you.
Right, and we've, I think, very much, well, not all horror filmmakers these days have lost that, but a lot of them have. We have gotten so much into special effects since now anything can be shown. You know, the reason Steven Spielberg didn't show the shark was because he couldn't get it to work right. and so they had to kind of shoot around it. And they realized wisely that once they had established how scary the shark was, all you really had to do was show the water. And we knew that the shark could be anywhere underneath there. And so that's part of it. And another thing that we particularly talking about Jaws, we should mention, is how important that music is. Mm. It's, you know, kind of immediately recognizable as soon as you hear it, just like the Halloween music that you played coming in. As soon as you hear that, bam, you, the viewer, are right into that movie and you're scared.
I think Jaws is from the 70s, and there are a bunch of others that come from that same era, like Carrie and The Shining and Amityville Horror. Was that kind of a golden age for horror movies?
In some ways it was, because that was right after the MPAA had changed their rating system so that the filmmakers could actually show more violence and things on screen than they'd been able to before. And we had a lot of independent people working and novels like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist were very popular. And, of course, you know, they made big-budget adaptations from those at the same time that the independent guys like George Romero were making Night of the Living Dead. And so I think that's when, in a way, the horror movie did come of age then and really became accepted by mainstream Hollywood in a way that it had not been before.
Let's give a listen to one of the classics. This is The Shining. Our producer Amanda Magnus loves this movie and tries to get us to play clips from it for any excuse she can find. So let's give a listen.
Wendy.
Sally!
Darling, light of my life. I'm not going to hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to bash your brains in.
So The Shining definitely stands out, not just for Amanda, but for a lot of people as a classic horror movie. Does it hold a special place for you, Mike?
I like that movie, but I don't love it. Like so much of Stanley Kubrick's films, I find them easier to admire than to really get involved in. And I have sort of the same objection to that Stephen King always has, that the Jack Nicholson character is kind of crazy from the beginning. He doesn't really go crazy the way he does in the novel. I also recommend the remake that Stephen King wrote was done for cable television back in the 90s, I think. And that's a very nice adaptation. Doesn't have the really slick production values that the Kubrick film does, but it's a really good version of that story.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We've got Sean with us in Wausau. Sean, hi.
Hello.
What's your movie?
The movie that still scares me, I just watched it the other day. I saw it for the first time when I was a teenager. Angel Heart, Mickey Rourke, Lisa Bonet, Robert De Niro. Terrifying movie. It wasn't really a slasher-type horror, but it was more psychological-type horror. Guy is a crooner, sells his soul to the devil, goes to World War II, has a traumatic injury, comes back, doesn't remember who he was or that he sold his soul to the devil.
Whoop.
Devil finds him and hires him as a private investigator, and the movie is him slowly unraveling the truth of who he is.
Well, spoiler alert, but how old were you when you saw that?
I was probably 13, 14.
Okay, that's pretty...
literally the scariest thing I'd ever seen up to that point.
Yeah, it's a little gruesome and a little sexual, too. It's not one I'm going to pull out for kids too early on.
No, that is, again, but again, talking about the, you know, is that, it is definitely supernatural. We've got the devil as a character in it, and I think as soon as you've got the devil, you know, in the credit list, then you've got a horror movie.
And you can join in and share your favorite horror movie. Maybe it's a cheeseball one. Maybe it's one that shaped your entire life. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you turn to when you really want to be scared? You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, something that's happened not that recently, but I guess in the more recent history of horror movies is sort of mashing them up with comedy. And one that really does that well is Shaun of the Dead. What do you think about that one, Mike?
I really like that movie. It was one of the first ones to really start playing with the idea of, you know, that we're all sort of zombies, as it were. And those guys just did such a terrific job with that. They obviously love American movies, and they just did a terrific. They made it. It's kind of a comedy, a parody of zombie movies, but it's also a really good zombie movie at the same time. And I share their quirky sense of humor. So I think that is really one of the finest comedies of recent years. And I also like all the other work that they've done.
Let's give a listen. This, I believe, they're trying to pretend to be zombies. There's a little acting lesson to look like zombies.
Take another look at the way he moves. Remember, very limp. Almost like sleepwalking. Look at the face. It's vacant with a hint of sadness. Like a drunk who's lost a bet. Okay, let's try, shall we? Liz. Nice. Good vocal work. Okay. Barbara, that's excellent.
Sorry, dear, I was miles away.
A clip from Shaun of the Dead. We're talking horror movies with Mike Mayo, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your favorite?
Well, you're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk to Mike Mayo, and we're going to get some of your takes in a little bit. Keep listening. Talking horror movies right now with Mike Mayo. He's the author of The Horror Show Guide, the ultimate fright fest of movies, and he's also a film critic who's contributed to The Washington Post and The Roanoke Times.
And we want to know, what's your favorite horror movie? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Let us know the one that scared you the most.
And we'll go to calls now. We've got Tom on the line from Lansing. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It's not special effects or supernatural or anything, but the most I've ever been startled in the movie theater was in Wait Until Dark.
The guy you think
is gone jumps on her. And that's still, actually, I still look around corners a little bit on that. It still attacks me to this day, and that was like 45 years ago.
Wow.
But it's one of those incidents where the whole thing builds up. You think he's gone, and whoa. And it really, I think everybody in the theater the whole bit. So I think that was a classic moment in film.
I have a story about that one. In high school band camp, they showed us that movie. And at the moment you're talking about, you had 90-plus teenagers screaming in the middle of the woods in this, you know, in the lodge. I'm sure people heard us from miles around when Alan Arkin jumped out there. Mike, how about you?
My memory is much the same. I remember seeing that movie in a theater in Chapel Hill. I took a date, and I think I still have 4 marks on my wrist where her fingernails.
Yep, these scars stay with us sometimes, don't they? All right, thanks a lot, Tom, for that call. We go to Carol in La Crosse. Hey, Carol.
Hi.
Hi.
Prince of Darkness. I feel like I've seen that. I don't remember it that well. Briefly, what was the deal with that one?
Yeah, the Catholic Church has kept this secret for centuries that the devil was on Earth at one time, and now he's coming back.
That's John Carpenter, I think, Mike Mayo, if I'm not wrong.
Yes, it is. It's a John Carpenter movie. It's not one of his best known, but I really like that movie, too, just because it tells a more complicated story than he normally does. And I haven't seen it in a long time. That's one I should take another look at, because I remember really getting into it and involved with it. There's all kinds of stuff that takes place down in a cellar, as I remember. Really wanted to take a look at it. And that's what's so cool about talking to fans like this. You remember movies like that. Somebody brings up something that you haven't seen in a long time, and then you can, you know, go back and, I hope we're all keeping our lists here, and take another look at it.
All right, well, let's give a listen to one of Veronica's favorites. This is the one you picked, I think, for our list, The Blair Witch Project.
And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted.
That was a fun one. It set it up as though it were real, and there was an amazing, they kind of invented viral marketing for that movie. Mike, is that one of your favorites?
I can't say it's one of my favorites. It's one, again, that I have to admire simply because of the brilliance of the marketing campaign. I remember they had so many people thinking that, you know, this was not a horror movie, this was a documentary. It really was literally found footage. And they kind of invented that whole school of horror. They, you know, they did one sequel to it that didn't really do too well, but then other people have picked it up with things like this Paranormal Activity series that Paramount has out that really does exactly the same thing. And the key to all these movies is they have really unknown cast, so they don't have to pay a lot for that. And then they're done in kind of deliberately crude style without sophisticated lighting or anything like that. So they are incredibly inexpensive for the studios to make. And if they get one that's a hit, like Paranormal Activity, it is just pure profits once people start buying tickets and DVDs.
What I like about that one is that it's for somebody like me. It's for wimps who really can't take like the super gory, super bloody things. There's still suspense and it's still scary, but it's kind of a little softer for people who just need to soft pedal that kind of thing. Do you have any recommendations for other wimps like me?
Oh, gosh, for other wimps like you. Now, that's... Yes, an older movie, and particularly appropriate since we're talking about Halloween, the adaptation of Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes. Again, one of my all-time favorite movies. It does have some scary stuff in it, but not a lot, as I recall. It's mostly done through the characters that you get to know. A just extremely well-made movie, well-crafted all the way through. That goes back to the 70s, too, I guess, or 80s. But I highly recommend that movie.
Excellent. We'll check that one out. And let's go back to the phones now, see what else people have on their minds. Greg in Madison is next. Hey, Greg.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
I really personally do not like scary movies, but I remember when I was 17, I worked in a movie theater, and we had the movie Carrie there for probably 4 months.
Mm.
And at the end of the movie, at the very last scene, all the ushers would walk down to the front of the theater and look up the crowd and watch the entire audience jump all the time.
That's awesome. So your entertainment was the audience who was completely freaked out. Yeah, Carrie, that was a big deal back, you know, in the day, wasn't it, Mike?
Yeah, and I remember what he said about, you know, watching the audience. Stephen King tells a really good story about, you know, he was not really involved very much with the making of that movie and didn't see it till he went out to an early screening in New York with a big crowd. And he said when that big last scare came out, and we won't give it away because there are probably still some people out there who haven't seen it, and the whole audience jumped and screamed, he said, "I knew right then, this is a hit."
And they're remaking Carrie, aren't they? What do you think about that?
With Chloe Moretz and, Julianne Moore. I suppose it's hard to argue with remaking horror movies because, again, it's pretty much a sure bet for the Hollywood studios. They've got a built-in audience. They don't require really huge budgets. And I really do think that younger kids, who say, discovered Carrie on DVD or on VHS, really want to see it again, want to see their version of it. And that's why these have been so incredibly popular. When we were putting together the Horror Show Guide, we realized we had to change the way the book was arranged because there were so many remakes and sequels in there that it was just wrong to talk about them individually. You had to get them all together to make any sense of what they were.
I want to get a little more zombie talk in here, and let's give a quick listen to a clip from The Night of the Living Dead, a zombie classic.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're acting like a child.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
So an older zombie movie, and zombies are really big these days. They never go out of style,
are.
Do they?
Yeah, and that was really the first zombie movie. And in fact, the word zombie is never used in that movie. They refer to them as ghouls at one time. But George Romero was just trying to make a movie as cheaply as he could, you know, using his friends and the best kind of actors and extras they could get there in Pennsylvania. And they made the discovery that, you know, all you really need is people, you know, kind of to look like shambling corpses, and you've got something that scares viewers. And from that movie, all the rest of them came up into this year's World War Z, which I think of as kind of the Gone with the Wind of zombies.
Do you like zombies as sort of the cultural horror movie zeitgeisty thing right now, or do you prefer some of the other bad guys like vampires?
I'm kind of done with zombies. I think I got done with zombies a few years ago with that terrific comedy Zombieland with Woody Harrelson.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. I like that.
It's a great movie. Another terrific one for people to see if they have happen to miss that one. Has a great cameo performance at the end that we won't give away. But and now we're seeing, look, one of the most popular shows on television is The Walking Dead. So the characters aren't going away, and they're going to keep doing new things with them as long as the audience is out there. Even if I'm not part of that audience, I have to admit that, you know, this is really kind of the horror character right now that seems to be the most popular.
Go back to the phones. We've got Deborah with us in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi. You're on the air.
You know, it's really interesting that I'm listening to all of this and laughing. It seems so funny, but I cannot watch scary movies. And the very first scary movie I saw, I was about 12 years old. It was called The Green Slime. And the same principle as the Sigourney Weaver movie, where you killed the monster and it multiplies.
Ah, yeah.
And then another one was, I don't know if it was a movie, but I was home. I was in junior high, I think, and I was home on a Saturday night alone. I was watching it, and it was on at midnight. And it was Dr. Tears House, of course.
Yes. Oh, I love that movie. That's Mike. Either of those, Green Slime or Dr. Tears House of Horrors.
No, I think we decided that Green Slime was more science fiction than horror, so it didn't get in there. But I, too, am a fan of Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. That's one of the great, I believe that's one of the anthology ones that they did back in the 60s. And those were really a lot of fun.
Well, for people who want to just sort of start with the elementals of horror movies, give us one or two recommendations for this Halloween.
Oh, wow. Well, okay, I already mentioned Something Wicked This Way Comes. That's a really good one. And if you're looking for something for kids, and this is maybe not exactly true horror, but I think of it as horror, Beetlejuice.
Oh, yeah.
The Tim Burton movie with Michael Keaton, that's just a lot of fun. And you can show it on a double feature with Edward Scissorhands.
Mike, thanks. We're out of time, but thanks so much for joining us again. A lot of fun, as always.
Glad to do it.
That was Mike Mayo, author of The Horror Show Guide, The Ultimate Fright Fest of Movies.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.